Hello, this is Judge Jim Gray from the Superior Court in Orange County, California. I'm the author of the book, Why Our Drug Laws Have Failed and What We Can Do About It, The Judicial Indictment on the War on Drugs. And you are listening right now to the Drug Truth Network with Dean Becker.
The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies.
Thank you for joining us on this edition of Century of Lies. Here in just a little bit, we'll bring in our guest, Charles Bowden. He's the author of A Shadow in the City, Confessions of an Undercover Drug Warrior. And if we have time, we'll hear from Doug McVeigh, Professor David Duncan, Ed Rosenthal, Cliff Thornton, and Loretta Nall.
I'm really proud that we have with us today the author of a new book, A Shadow in the City, Confessions of an Undercover Drug Agent, Mr. Charles Bowden. Hello, sir.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This may be a work of fiction. Then again, maybe it's not, because there seems to be an awful lot of truth in what you write here, sir.
Well, there is no fiction. What happened was, to get that close to an undercover drug operation, I had to change the names and not disclose the city. But outside of that, there is not a single invention. Since, as you know, these undercover operations are heavily filmed and recorded, so everything in it is exact to fact.
Well, sir, it's a rather chilling tale, then, is it not, if this is the reality that we're dealing with in this drug war?
Well, it is the reality. I mean, everyone in the drug business, whether they're a narc or a dealer, winds up betraying everyone else and then destroys themselves in various ways. I can't think of a more unhealthy way to live except possibly running a death camp in World War II or something. It's doomed for everyone.
I deal with many members. There's a new organization, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And this is a group of, you know, former and some current policemen, judges, district attorneys, and so forth. And many of them have done the Saul turns to Paul, if you know what I'm saying there.
Yes. Well, look at the protagonist in the book, Joey O'Shea, who's an actual person. During the course of the 4 years I was working on it, came out against the drug war. He decided it should be legalized. He is no longer a narc, even though he spent 20 years undercover. He reached the conclusion many people reached, that what we call the war on drugs is more deadly than the drugs.
Absolutely true, sir. We arrest 1.6 million of our fellow citizens each year for flowers or other plant products.
Well, also it doesn't work. I mean, even if you had some deep belief that drugs were terrible, what we're spending $30-40 billion a year on for narcs doesn't work at all. Drugs have never been more available, the quality's never been higher, the price has never been less. But if this were a business, it would have been put out of its misery years ago, meaning the war on drugs. But what it is a monster that finances narcs, keeps the federal courthouses packed, and finances a huge prison system. It has to feed itself. Why else do you think we're paying guys $100,000 a year to bus college kids for holding raves, which is essentially what they're doing with ecstasy? We've created a monster that's eating us.
Well, yes, sir, we have. And the book, again, A Shadow in the City, also looks at the international implications.
Well, the book is about an international heroin deal that, if it had gone through, would have produced $500 million worth of heroin on the street in 12 months. And frankly, it was a drop in the bucket. It involves Colombians of the highest level and Dominicans of the highest level. It probably caused the death, torture, or total destruction of 300 people, the case. And when it was over, there was no one in this country ever knew it happened, meaning the heroin arrived on time. It's almost a model of the futility of the war on drugs. And it, of course, broke everyone in it. It's the reason this guy retired, essentially, after 20 years. He just couldn't do it anymore. He thought he decided what he was doing was wrong.
Sure, he determines that some of the friends, if you will, he's developed along the way, the lovers, in fact, that he had to destroy, tend to destroy the person doing that.
Well, also, he came from a lower-class background, and the odd thing is, he liked drug dealers better than a lot of the officers he worked with, because drug dealers worked harder and had a stronger work ethic. And so, yes, he not only bonded with them, he became friends with them. Him from filling prisons with them, but it did give him pause eventually as to what he was doing. Imagine being a great predator, which he is. And so for 20 years, he was like a one-man war machine, a kind of Rambo running loose in the United States. Now he's retired. He literally just walked off the job after the book was done. But I must say, I had nothing to do with that. I didn't have arguments with him. We became friends. You know, he decided that on his own, based on far more experience than I will ever have.
Charles, this is not your first book. I see that you've written another book, perhaps somewhat similar, Down by the River, Drugs, Money, Murder, and Family.
Yeah, Down by the River is a history of 40 years of the drug war on the border, and a kind of memorial to the tens of thousands of people that have died in that drug war. The book we're discussing earlier is kind of my exit interview from the drug world. I wanted to capture what it felt like inside. Everybody talks about the war on drugs. I wanted to get down on paper not only what it does to the people that sell drugs, but what it does to the narcs we hire to enforce these laws. As I said earlier, it destroys everyone. Nobody gets out of the drug world intact. No one.
You wrote about the fact that they have their drug of choice to help drown their...
Oh, yeah, all cops. Most cops that really know the street wind up drinking. You know, you have to drown your sorrows. That's true. And, of course, it's easy to say that's a hypocrisy, because, of course, it is. But alcohol, we gave up on prohibition for it. We haven't given up on drugs. The fact is, most people seem to think the war on drugs has gone away because nobody's bothering them. But, in fact, if you check that arrest record that you mentioned earlier, about half those people are simply getting arrested for marijuana. The thing goes on relentlessly, to no point.
Well, I know you write for various publications as well. I'm sure you're tracking what's going on the borders right now, perhaps especially Nuevo Laredo with that ongoing...
Oh, yeah, it's an act, you know, it's hyper-violence. This is a characteristic. I did a book on Juarez once, which was just Death Incorporated. What do you, you know, you're never going to stop drugs from coming in with a border as porous as ours. You're never going to stop people from trying to bring them in who have no, if they have no money. And you're never going to get rid of the violence as long as it's illegal. Your listeners surely know that drugs would be almost worthless if they were illegal. They're not very hard to produce. So we've created a lucrative income for people who are willing to take the risk to import drugs. And of course, since it's illegal, they're heavily armed to protect their interests. And so a lot of people die. Thousands. All the time. And everybody pretends it isn't happening, like these people don't matter. Well, that's not true. I've known drug dealers who got killed, too. It's not just narcs.
Well, I know the Germans declared Jews and gypsies to be exterminable. And we've done much the same thing with drug users, have we not?
Well, yes. But we've also done it with drug dealers. We act like every time we arrest a Mexican who's trying to make a living, that he's some kingpin or something. And this is nonsense. I mean, you have a country that's in such terrible shape, at least 500,000 of its people flee it every year and come to the United States to work. You can hardly be surprised that some people will pick up a gun and try to make a living moving marijuana, cocaine, and heroin, and methamphetamine into the United States. And, of course, you know, everybody knows this. The only reason, quote, drug dealers exist and smugglers is because Americans want the drugs. I mean, it's a preposterous circumstance. But there isn't a politician, hardly, in the United States that will stand up and be accounted for it. Nobody will speak out. Once in a while, somebody like Johnson in New Mexico, who's retiring as governor, will speak out. But no one else will. Become the big taboo in our culture to look at reality on this issue.
So true. The fact is that under our current circumstance, we will never eliminate these drugs. We'll never stop the dealers. We'll never make any difference whatsoever, will we?
No. It's almost like a war on an underclass, because let's face it, the people who go to prison, most of them aren't Harvard graduates. You can go to a doctor if you're a Rush Limbaugh and get plenty of drugs, or anybody else I know. What we do is prosecute people for self-medicating instead of paying a tariff to physicians. As I say, if people like this reality, well, they're going to love the future because everything's going to be more of the same, only worse. This won't go away. We're never going to eliminate drugs from our culture the way it's constituted any more than we can get rid of alcohol. The only thing we can decide is whether we spend tens of billions on cops that don't make a difference and tens of billions or hundreds of billions on prisons that incarcerate our own citizens simply because they want to alter their state of being, their mood. It's almost a vile reality.
I would agree it's vile, certainly, sir. This cop, Mr. Joy O'Shea, the star of this book, relay my thanks to him. And
well, I will, and also I must say he was an exemplary officer. This is a guy, if you want somebody that went to the mountain, it's this man. He has personally known 43 officers that have died in the line of duty. But this isn't a dirty cop or something. This is a guy who gave it his all and decided it wasn't worth it. But he's the best narc I've ever met by far. It's like a genius at it. And I learned a lot from him, and I'm grateful.
His international involvement, his ability to juggle many balls at once in getting all this work done certainly speaks of his acumen.
He's highly intelligent and very gifted. He's kind of like a natural athlete. Unfortunately, he stopped believing in the game, and so did I. So it's like an Olympian retiring. But it won't make any difference. The machine clanks on, and it is today. Eventually, somebody in this country is going to, the people in this country are going to have to wake up and smell the coffee. If they don't, half the country is going to be behind bars eventually, because it just keeps growing, the punishment syndrome.
Well, very good. We've been speaking with Mr. Charles Bowden, the author of A Shadow in the City, Confessions of an Undercover Drug Agent. I thank you, Mr. Bowden.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, sir.
It's been a pleasure. Adios.
My name is Cliff Thornton, and this is Efficacy. And my report today is on the drug policy conference that's taking place in Hartford, Connecticut on October 21st and 22nd at Trinity College. It is presented by the City of Hartford, hosted by Trinity College, and sponsored by Aetna Foundation. There are four bullets that we put together to summarize the conference: the point, the aim, the audience, and the goal. The conference, under the point, is to bring law enforcement groups, state agencies, state and city representatives, and national experts with creative talent to meet the drug Scrooge head on. The aim of the conference is to challenge these experts to tell us what resources are needed to increase success rates and efforts to reduce drug use and its associated social and criminal ramifications. The audience that we are targeting is city policymakers, state agency representatives, legislators, caregivers from a wide range of social services, medical providers, representatives of problem-solving committees and neighborhood organizations, church members, and city residents. The goal of the conference is to provide up-to-the-minute information which would lead to the next steps, conclusions, and ongoing discussions and a community of advocates for possible policy changes that will make a real difference in people's lives. This is Cliff Thornton reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
It's time to identify this jurisdiction by its drug laws. This nation will arrest smugglers bringing more than 3 kilos of cocaine through customs. Despite this nation's laissez-faire attitude towards all drugs, to include heroin, ecstasy, and marijuana, their rate of drug use is 50% that of the United States for both adults and children. Nevertheless, the U.S. drug czar proclaimed this nation's drug problems to be enormous. Anybody want to go Dutch?
I'm Dr. David Duncan. I'm an epidemiologist and president of a small consulting firm, Duncan & Associates, as well as a faculty member at Brown University Medical School and director of the Fairview Community Health Center in Bowling Green, Kentucky.
I keep seeing these stories about pain doctors being arrested, tried in some sentence to 25 years to life even, for providing pain pills to people that are in severe pain. What's your thoughts there, sir?
Well, I think this is one of the more horrifying results of this nation's current drug policies. It's been a problem to some extent ever since the Federal Narcotics Bureau started exceeding their congressionally intended authority under the old Harrison Narcotics Act and started arresting doctors who were treating patients for addiction. But now we have doctors who are treating legitimate pain patients with appropriate medication who are being arrested for doing so out of the hysteria about the idea that somehow some addict is going to get some legal pain pills from a physician.
Well,
and
sir,
it's a horrendous result of the current policies.
The truth be told, even these illegal drugs, heroin, say, don't kill the number of people that would justify this war in the first place, does it?
No, all of the illicit drugs taken together, the number of deaths and medical problems that they cause pale in comparison to those associated with legal prescription drugs. And legal prescription drugs are minuscule compared to the deaths associated with alcohol, and even that is small compared to the deaths and disability associated with tobacco. So we're definitely focusing on the wrong drugs.
In the work you do, you are involved with people who use some of these illicit drugs?
Yes, although I'm primarily a researcher, I do a little clinical work and have in the past done a lot of clinical work. So I've worked with a lot of patients who were addicted to various drugs, especially heroin addicts.
During those years of observation, are those who use drugs down in the gutter, or are they always cast out from society?
Oh, no. Even among those who are addicted, many are functioning to some degree within society. You will find addicts who are successful in their profession who have enough income and good enough connections to get their drug. And, of course, most of the people who use any of the illegal drugs are not addicts and are having no problems functioning. You will find many more users of any of the drugs, even heroin, who are not addicted than who are. And you will find those persons at all levels of society and in all kinds of jobs and positions. I've known heroin users who were pastors of churches, who were successful physicians, who were college professors, who were bankers, who were a member of the local school board, people who use the drugs occasionally and without ever becoming addicted. And this is very much a common pattern with all the drugs, except tobacco. 70 to 90% of the people who use the drug on a regular basis are non-addicts.
Do you have a website you would like to send folks to?
Certainly anybody who's interested in seeing some of the things that I've written on this subject and connections to other websites of interest could go to www.duncan-associates.com, which is my company's website. We have a variety of publications on drug policy and drug use topics that are available to be downloaded. And, of course, www.stopthedrugwar.com is another good site.
I wanted to ask your observation, your fellow doctors and clinicians, why are they so silent on this subject? What will it take to break this logjam of real truth that could help change this situation?
I think that a lot of clinicians in the field are quiet about it because it is dangerous to speak out. You don't want the DEA snooping over your records to see if you prescribe one pain pill or one sleeping pill too many to a patient. You don't want to have a reputation in the community for being soft on drugs. A lot of people are scared of it. But when David Lewis founded the group, Physician Leadership on National Drug Policy, which is now called Physicians and Lawyers on National Drug Policy, and brought together the top leadership in the medical profession, the president and past president of the AMA, the editors of the New England Journal of Medicine and the Journal of the American Medical Association and so forth, all together in a meeting, past surgeon generals who'd been under under Reagan, under Bush, under Carter. There was complete agreement with them that the current drug policies were a terrible mistake, that we should be taking a public health and treatment approach, not a criminalization approach. And so it's clear that the leadership within the field of medicine does not support the present policy, but has been slow to speak out. And I think more and more are beginning to speak out, fortunately. And hopefully that's going to help with swaying the public to support rational policies instead of a continuation of a failed war on drugs.
It's been just a little over a year ago this month that Jonathan Magbe, a quadriplegic gentleman from Washington, D.C., was sentenced to 10 days in jail for misdemeanor marijuana possession, a first offense, and he died as a result of going to jail. And I want to update you on that. Mother sues over D.C. inmate's death, city hospital accused of not giving proper care. The mother of a quadriplegic inmate who died after suffering breathing problems at the D.C. jail has filed a lawsuit accusing the district government and Greater Southeast Community Hospital of failing to give him proper care. Standing on the courthouse steps nearly a year after her son, Jonathan Magbe, died of acute respiratory failure, Mary Scott said she wants justice for what her suit called the repeated failures and brutal insensitivity of the city and hospital. My baby lost 40 pounds in 4 days, and they never lifted a finger. No one should have been treated like that, Scott said. He needed medical attention, and they turned their backs on him. Magbe, 27, of Mitchellville, was paralyzed from the neck down after being hit by a drunk driver when he was four. On October 20, 2004, he sat in his mouth-operated wheelchair as D.C. Superior Court Judge Judith E. Retchin sentenced him to 10 days in jail for a misdemeanor charge of possession of marijuana. He was a first-time offender. Magbe was taken to the D.C. jail, and within hours, he was having difficulty breathing. He was moved to the emergency room at Greater Southeast. The hospital released him to the jail the next day. On September 24th, he was again taken to the jail, where he died that day. An investigation by the Commission on Judicial Disabilities and Tenure cleared Retchin of blame, concluding that she acted within the law. I spent about 10 days protesting in front of Judge Retchin's courthouse last year with a sign that said she's guilty of judicial homicide. I was harassed by some police officers, and the federal marshal who drove Mr. Magbe to jail came out and thanked me for protesting and shed tears that about his involvement. And I'm happy to see that this family is filing a lawsuit. What happened to Jonathan Magbe is unspeakable, you know, and I wish that Judith Retchin, had she had more than a black hole for a heart, had somehow been held responsible. Unfortunately, she still sits on the bench waiting to pounce on the next hapless, helpless, quadriplegic medical marijuana smoker with the unfortunate luck to get rolled into her courtroom on hearing day. We must end the drug war. Please do your part. This is Loretta Nall with the U.S. Marijuana Party. Until next time, y'all be safe and stay out of Judge Judith Retchin's courtroom.
Hi, this is Ed Rosenthal, a big fan of the Drug Truth Network.
Ed, your appeal process is still grinding its way, is it not? Tell us how that's proceeding.
The appeals court just heard the oral arguments, and they're presented after all the briefs are presented. So it's the final chance that both sides have to change the judge's opinion.
Yeah, Ed, let's tell the folks a little of the history. Why this appeal is even necessary?
The appeal's necessary because we had major constitutional issues that would affect everybody in all the states in the Ninth Circuit where there's a where there are medical marijuana laws. The main issue was on this federal statute called 885D, and that's a statute that immunizes narcotics officers from being arrested under federal law. That is, they buy drugs, they sell drugs, they possess drugs, they transfer drugs. So there's a federal law that immunizes them as long as they're carrying out government duties. And the city of Oakland, understanding that law, said, well, as long as the law says, as long as the officer is carrying out city policy, they're immune from prosecution. So the city of Oakland immunized me. Instead of trying to arrest people, I was asked to distribute medical marijuana, that is, marijuana to patients. We had basically two arguments on that point, on 885D. The first was that the law itself was a valid law and that the federal government violated it when they arrested me, and that therefore there should have been no indictment, no trial, nothing, that I'm a free man. And the second was that if the judges didn't like that argument, at least I should be given the given estoppel, and that is that even though I might have been wrong, I was misdirected by the government, and therefore I shouldn't suffer when the government misdirected me, because the city government told me that I was immune from prosecution. And then another was a juror misconduct, when one of the jurors sought legal advice, and it was erroneous legal advice, and it did irreparable harm to my case. So the judges seemed very receptive to that, and also, in an upswing, they told the prosecutor that they were not going to reexamine my sentencing, which was only one day, because the Supreme Court had made a decision in another case, the Booker case, that said that the mandatory minimums were no longer. So altogether, I'm very optimistic about it. And also, I had a good panel of judges who were very receptive and seemed to understand what the issues were.
Well, Ed, when will you learn more? When will they make their decision?
They have between 2 and 6 months, I should have a decision. And it's very likely that if they decide in my favor, that the government will appeal to the Supreme Court.
Place 12 monkeys in a room. Place a ladder in the middle of the room. Hang a bunch of bananas from the ceiling over the ladder. Leave the room and watch through a two-way mirror. When the first monkey starts climbing the ladder, seeking bananas, whack the monkey with a broomstick. Whack additional monkeys as necessary to prevent them from reaching the bananas. Continue this effort until the monkeys begin stopping one another from climbing the ladder. Remove one of the original 12 monkeys and replace with a monkey who has never been whacked with a broom. Watch as the original monkeys keep the newbie from climbing the ladder. Replace the original monkeys one by one. Watch as a room full of unwhacked monkeys keep one another from the ladder and the bananas, even though none of them know the original reason to refrain. Observe the perfect example of the mechanisms of drug war in action. Well, I hope you enjoyed this edition of Century of Lies, and that you'll keep in mind that there is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data, no religious underpinnings, no moral clarity, no reason whatsoever for this drug war to continue. The drug war serves as a mechanism, as a bludgeon for a new dark age. We've been duped. The drug lords run both sides of this equation. Please do your part to help end this madness. Prohibido istak evilesco. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.